Welcome to Walden Pod. I'm your host, Emerson Green. My guest today is Dr. Michael Humer. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado and is the author of more than 70 academic articles in epistemology, ethics, metaethics, metaphysics, and political philosophy, as well as several books, including Skepticism in the Veil of Perception, Ethical Intuitionism, Paradox Lost, and Dialogues on Ethical Vegetarianism, as well as his new book, Knowledge, Reality, and Value, A Mostly Common Sense Guide to Philosophy. Today we focus on phenomenal conservatism, which is a theory in epistemology that seeks to ground justified beliefs in the way things appear or seem to the subject who holds that belief. We discuss a wide range of issues in epistemology, including internalism versus externalism, justified true belief, proper functionalism, the epistemic value of psychedelic experiences, religious experiences, radical skepticism, knowledge, conceptual analysis, intuition, and much else. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Professor Michael Humer. Okay, so I'm here with Michael Humer. Thank you for coming on.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So we'll be skipping around a lot from subject to subject because I'm new to epistemology and I want to ask you a bunch of questions I have, but while keeping phenomenal conservatism as kind of our center of gravity. So I've only for, a few months, tried to make an intentional effort to learn about epistemology. It's always just been incidental, learning about philosophy of religion, you'll just kind of accidentally pick up some things about Bayesian epistemology or something like that. But actually that's how I came across phenomenal conservatism, because I was preparing for a debate learning about skeptical theism, which is just the idea that our epistemic limitations should cast doubt on whether we can say gratuitous suffering actually exists. And I noticed that there's a tension between skeptical theism and phenomenal conservatism, which many Christians seem to favor. So I looked more into it and I'm more and more sympathetic to it. And, certainly right away I thought this is, descriptively accurate. This is, an accurate description of how we in fact form beliefs and navigate the world. And I'm really coming around to just endorsing the position. And, we can talk more about why I like it as we go on. I have lots of questions about it, but we should probably define what we're going to be talking about here. So would you mind giving us a definition of phenomenal conservatism?
Yeah, so, basically it's a view that it's rational to assume things are the way they appear unless you have reason for thinking otherwise, right? Or as I sometimes stated, if it seems to you that P, then if you don't have any defeaters, then... you have at least some justification for believing P.
Right. So the world seems a certain way to you, and until you've been given a good reason to think otherwise, you're justified in thinking that the world is how it seems. That should be our starting point.
Yeah. Makes sense, right?
Yeah, it does make sense. it seems to be true. Something I like about this idea is that it is really simple. So what you just laid out there is one of those deceptively simple ideas in philosophy that you might not really appreciate, its ramifications unless you've kind of wrestled with certain problems for a while, problems with skepticism or something like that. So that principle that you just outlined, if it seems to S that P, then S has some justification for believing that P, in the absence of defeaters, that can account for, many different kinds of beliefs that sometimes, we get hung up on. Beliefs about our own minds or other minds, or as you've talked about, moral truths or mathematical truths, sensory experience, intuition, memory, that kind of thing. So it's a really simple principle that you just outlined can get you all of that and avoid, problems with skepticism. And yeah, so it's a simple idea with really dramatic consequences.
Yeah, that's right. I note that, a lot of theists like it. Because if you apply it to religious experience, then you have your prima facie justification for believing whatever you seemed to experience. And, you know, a lot of atheists don't, like, atheists would not recognize that if they didn't accept phenomenal conservatism to begin with. Like, a lot of people say, oh, no, you don't have any evidence that your experience is veridical or whatever. And my view is, well, you don't need evidence that your experience is veridical. You need reason to doubt it if you're not going to believe it, right? So, you know, I'm not a theist, but, you know, I can still say they have some prima facie justification.
Yeah. So where do you think that idea comes from, like, particularly in the online atheist community, like that kind of, I don't know if you want to call it like naive evidentialism, but just the idea that, like, oh, you can't trust your intuitions, you can't trust your experiences, you just have to have like evidence and preferably scientific evidence for like anything that you think.
Yeah, I mean, like, on the surface of it, that sounds like a rational position, right? Oh, yeah, you need evidence, right? But, I mean, what has happened is that they just haven't thought through. They just don't know what they mean by evidence or, like, what they think evidence is. And, you know, like, the people who claim to be rejecting intuitions, they haven't thought that through. They don't know what they mean by intuition or, like, I mean, this is my best guess, right? They don't have a theory of what they themselves are doing at the moment. But if you think it through for like a little bit more, you realize that, you know, there's no coherent account of what you yourself are doing when you're saying that, right? Like, are you saying what seems to you to be the case or not?
Right. Like even the idea, like, their kind of evidentialism is based on a kind of seeming, right?
Yeah. Right. What is evidence? Like, how do you get evidence for anything? So you have sensory experiences and you're saying that's evidence. Why is that evidence? And you know, like the think about the skeptical arguments, which are kind of parallel to, like, the external world skepticism is kind of parallel to, you know, skepticism about everything else, right? Like, the external world skeptic says, oh, but you don't have any evidence that your senses are reliable. So, right? So if you have to collect independent evidence that your experiences are reliable in general, then, you know, you're going to be screwed. You're going to be a radical skeptic. But if you do accept sensory evidence, then why wouldn't you accept all appearances, you know, at face value? This reminds me of an episode of Star Trek Voyager, which was a great TV show. There's some time when the character Kes has developed like psychic powers or something and mental telepathy, and the Vulcan character Tuvok says at one point, I remind you that we have no evidence that Kes's experiences are reliable or whatever. And I thought, well, you have no evidence that any experiences are reliable unless you're allowed to use your experiences, right, to support each other, to support themselves or to support each other. But if you allow that, then there's nothing wrong with the ESP experiences. So,
yeah, I want to get to some of those like unusual experiences or like weird appearances and stuff like that. But, you know, I was bothered by skepticism. I mean, I don't know how long, it's kind of like in the past at this point, but like radical skepticism actually used to bother me. Like, it wasn't just like an intellectual thing. Like, I would actually, you know, it would upset me sometimes. So, you know, phenomenal conservatism, I don't know, it was just such a simple and like straightforward way of avoiding skepticism. You know, I didn't have to rely on sort of like pragmatic justifications, which seems to be where a lot of people default when they don't know where else to go. But yeah, so skepticism like external world skepticism, or like kind of radical Cartesian skepticism, or, you know, like Bertrand Russell's thing about like, how do you know the world wasn't created 5 minutes ago with all your memories? Yeah, so that kind of stuff used to bother me. And then, but, you know, I'm being pulled in like two different directions here, but so the possibility of skepticism doesn't constitute a defeater, right, under phenomenal conservatism.
Right, yeah. Yeah, otherwise there'd be no point, right? So if the mere possibility of your being wrong is a defeater, then there was no point in saying anything about, you know, appearances being a source of justification, because there's always going to be that defeater and it's never going to be removed, right?
Right. So we have an idea of, you know, what is meant by seeming. We kind of outlined a few examples, like, you know, or appearance. You know, we have like these appearances of, you know, memory or intuition, which I think you define intuition as like an intellectual seeming, which I like that. Yeah, like, so appearances of all sorts. So we have some idea of what's meant by that, like if it, you know, seems to someone that something is the case. But for those who might not be familiar with the language, what is a defeater?
Just grounds for doubt. So, mm-hmm. you know, you have a belief or you have a reason for a belief, and you acquire something that's grounds for doubting that proposition. Either it could either be evidence against the proposition, or it could just be evidence that the way you formed the belief was defective, that it's unreliable or something like that.
Right. Yeah, I think some people misunderstand like what phenomenal conservatives are getting at. Like, they sort of think that, like, well, you know, you can just believe anything that appears to you to be the case, and then that's like the end of the story, and like they can just dust off their hands. But
it's not the end of the story, but it is the beginning of the story.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the default, like, starting point.
Yeah, right. So, you know, we're doing this thing of reasoning and forming beliefs, and there has to be some starting point, right? And what is it going to be, right?
Mm-hmm. So phenomenal conservatism is your starting point. It's like your foundational epistemic theory. Like, what are some competing epistemic, competing, like, foundational theories, or, like, competing, like, starting points that people have proposed?
Yeah. You know, there's the externalists, right? Where they think that a belief is justified if it in fact was formed by a reliable method, and the believer doesn't need to have any reason to think that it's reliable. Okay. So then, you know, if you actually have psychic powers and they're actually reliable, then you're justified in, you know, believing whatever your psychic intuitions. And if it's not actually reliable, then you're not justified. Right. So, you know, on this view, you can't necessarily tell if you're justified or not. Yeah. What would be other views? The popular alternative internalist view has traditionally been the acquaintance theory, which says, well, you have a kind of direct awareness of certain things, and then you have foundationally justified beliefs about those things. The people who hold this view generally would say that you are not acquainted with any physical objects. They would say that you're acquainted only with your own mental states and possibly with some abstract objects, you know, like numbers or whatever, so that you can get a priori beliefs, a priori knowledge. Right. So, like, that was Russell's view. And what's the difference between acquaintance and appearance? Well, so acquaintance is supposed to be a real relation between you and something. So if you're acquainted with the fact that P, then P has to be the case. It guarantees that P is the case. If it merely seems to you that P, that doesn't guarantee P. So it could seem to you that P and you could be wrong. You know, like, so I'm sure there are other theories could be talked about. I think those are maybe those are the two biggest alternative views.
Right. So there's this, like, divide between internalists and externalists, and you kind of outlined it there, but so phenomenal conservatism is on the internalist side of this. But could you just quickly, like, outline, you know, like, what is this dispute exactly between internalists and externalists?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there might be some dispute about what the dispute itself is.
Yeah.
So there's different views about the analysis of knowledge, and then there's views about justification. As views about knowledge, I think externalist views about knowledge are basically ones that reject the internalist justification condition. What's internal justification? Well, it's like justification from the subject's own point of view. And, you know, the externalist would have, they would either reject justification as being, as a requirement for knowledge. They'd say you can know something without being justified in believing it. Or they would say, well, you can be justified in believing something, even though from your own point of view, it's indistinguishable from something else that's unjustified. Right. Anyway, so the externalist view of justification is whether you're justified in believing something depends upon factors that are external to you, external to your mind. So, like, the actual reliability of your belief-forming method, that's an external feature. It's, right, that's not just inside your own mind. And the internalist thinks that, no, you know, whether you're justified or not should depend entirely on, you know, the character of your own mental states. Sometimes, so there's, like, you know, two slightly different versions of internalism, right? One is that you have to, the factors that make you justified have to be things that you could be directly aware of. And the other version is just to say the factors that make you justified have to be things in your own mind.
What's the difference there?
Stuff that's going on in your own mind, it's not necessarily obvious that you could be aware of what's going on in your own mind.
Okay, so there, you can have like introspective access, or you might not, but it's still a part of your mind. Like it could be a part of your subconscious or something.
Yeah, right.
Or a part, or just like in like an inference that you're making unconsciously.
Yeah, yeah, and like there might be a debate about whether you could have direct awareness of something that's not in your mind.
Okay, so this dispute between internalist and externalist, it's about like justification, right? Again, I'm being pulled in like two different directions about like justification and like other forms of externalism that I find interesting. So one thing that I like about phenomenal conservatism that I gleaned from reading Compassionate Phenomenal Conservatism, which was the thing that introduced me to it, is that it seems like it's compatible with certain externalist theories. It's just that like, you know, phenomenal conservatism is like, you know, it's the more fundamental thing, but like you can go on to affirm like proper functionalism or something, right?
Oh, well, phenomenal conservatism doesn't imply anything about the analysis of knowledge, right? But it's, you know, that's just like a semantic question about how the word know is used, so.
Well, that was the first direction I was being pulled into. Maybe I should have gone there first. Okay, so the dispute is between, it's over justification. So, according to phenomenal conservatives, you have a certain belief. You might have a justification for that belief based on the way things appear to you. And let's just say for fun that it's also a true belief. So you've got a justified true belief. So, that doesn't count as knowledge, right?
Yeah, it depends, right?
Well, I guess that's what I wanted to talk about is just this whole like justified true belief conception of knowledge and Gettier cases and all that. So from what I gather, the consensus is that justified true belief isn't knowledge, at least some of the time.
Yeah, yeah. So justified true belief isn't sufficient for knowledge, as shown by the Gettier cases. As far as I know, almost no one thinks that it might be. And the only person I know of who thinks that, you know, maybe knowledge is justified true belief is Brian Weatherson. But other than that, there's a consensus that if there's only one guy, I think we can still say there's a consensus. You know, justified true belief is not sufficient.
Would you mind just giving an example of a Gettier case? Because I don't want to just blow by all this for people who might not be familiar.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think this is the best example. This is not in Gettier's paper, but this is a better example. So you look at a stopped clock. So you look at the clock on the wall, it says 3 o'clock. Unbeknownst to you, it's actually a stopped clock. Also, coincidentally, it just happens to be 3 o'clock at the time that you're looking at it. All right, so it seems like you're justified in thinking that it's 3 o'clock. Like this is the way that people normally find out what the time is. This example was devised back when most people had analog clocks, not a digital clock. Okay, so anyway, looks like you're justified and you got it right. Right, you think it's 3 o'clock and it's 3 o'clock, but that's not, you don't know the time, right?
Right. I guess the intuition there is just that, like, if you're lucky, then it doesn't really count as knowledge.
Yeah, right. It's just a matter of luck that you got the time right. So even though it is justified, right, it's still a matter of luck.
So just, you know, really quick, easy question. What is knowledge?
Yeah, that sounds like a quick, easy question. That was, it's unanalyzable. All right, but it's something close to justified true belief, but you require a little bit more. You know, I think the closest analysis is the defeasibility analysis, where you have to not have any defeaters, okay, in addition to justified true belief. No, you have to have no defeaters, where defeaters are true propositions such that if you added them to your beliefs, it would make you no longer justified in believing the thing in question. Right, so in this case, the clock is stopped as a defeater. Right, so the subject doesn't know that, but if you added to their belief system that the clock is stopped, then they wouldn't be justified in believing that it was 3 o'clock. And so that's why it's not knowledge. Okay, now I don't think this, so even this I think is not a perfect analysis, but you have to get increasingly complicated to get counterexamples, right? I don't think anyone has gotten an analysis that's completely free of counterexamples, but I'm not really worried by that because I think that's true of basically every concept. Hmm. Right? Like, basically, philosophers never analyzed anything successfully.
What about Married Bachelor?
Yeah, so I intentionally said philosophers because I take it that because I'm, you know, talking about like philosophically interesting terms, right?
Okay.
So bachelor might be, yeah, so it's traditionally analyzed as an unmarried man, although it's not even clear that that's a correct analysis. Okay, so is the Pope a bachelor? I mean, that seems a little odd, right? But is he an unmarried man? Unquestionable, right?
Right. Okay. Yeah. No, I'm kind of with you that like this conceptual analysis of like, you know, constantly trying to identify like the necessary and sufficient conditions for any concept and like trying to find this like kind of foolproof definition for everything. It does just kind of strike me as like a fool's errand on some level, like not just with, you know, knowledge, but I mean, like you said, like with it seems like, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but if it seems like if philosophers have just failed to like analyze anything adequately, then doesn't that kind of imply that like this whole idea of conceptual analysis is just sort of overrated and maybe we shouldn't get too hung up on it?
Yes. Yeah. It's a waste of time, right? We never succeeded. We've been doing philosophy for 2000 years. And, you know, Plato started with this thing, what is such and such, you know, where you try to define such and such. What is knowledge? What is virtue? And what is justice? And you'd try to define and then you would never succeed, right? Like the definitions people offered would always be refuted. So, you know, Western philosophy starts there and then it goes right up to the present day. We still have never succeeded. Right? So, okay, and I think there is there's an interesting explanation for this, right? So if you thought that we need definitions and that we can reasonably easily do them, it's probably because you had a certain view about the nature of concepts, that you think that most concepts are constructed out of other concepts, and that understanding a term is understanding its definition. And I would suggest that what we've learned from the history of failures of analysis is that theory of concepts and word meanings is wrong, right? Most concepts are not constructed out of other concepts. And understanding a concept is not knowing the definition. Right? Understanding a concept is having the appropriate dispositions to apply a term in the appropriate circumstances. The way you get these correct dispositions is not by hearing the definition. It is by observing people using the word and then attempting to imitate their usage. And so the capacity to imitate other people's usage is just sort of hardwired into the human brain, and it doesn't require getting a verbal definition.
Yeah. So is that kind of along the lines of use theory?
Yeah, that meaning is determined by use.
Right. Like social function and stuff.
Yeah, this is a vaguely Wittgensteinian view, which I'm sorry to say because I don't like most of Wittgenstein's work, but I think he had insights into the nature of language.
Yeah, I recently tried to figure out what naturalism means, and you know, I kind of ran into this same problem, and I did kind of reference this whole idea that, you know, the social function here is like a more plausible candidate for like how these terms have meaning. And if we know how to use these terms, then we can say that they mean something. And, you know, most people wouldn't say that God is natural or something. Like God is like the paradigmatic example of something supernatural. So it's like when people are asking for these like, you know, necessary and sufficient conditions of like supernatural and natural, and like, no, what is the metaphysical difference between the supernatural and natural? It's like, well, I don't even know if I can answer that. It's certainly not like in all cases of how everyone has ever used those terms, but you have a sense of like what counts as natural and what counts as supernatural. Like, you know how those terms are typically used, and it seems like that's enough to at least like demarcate between natural and supernatural.
Yeah. I mean, so like if somebody asks you, what does naturalism mean or what does natural mean? So they might actually not understand. They might be like not just being a philosopher and say, oh, that's good. They might actually not understand how you're using the word because it might be a technical use in philosophy. Okay, but what I suggest is, although I don't think we generally succeed in giving like perfect counterexample-free definitions, you can give an approximate explanation, right? Like, I think knowledge is approximately defeasible, indefeasible, justified true belief, okay? And the other thing that you can do is you can give examples. So you should give examples that would kind of show why you formed that category. Mm-hmm. And the other person will probably get it. Like, right, give examples of stuff that you think is natural and stuff that you think is not natural, and they might get the sense of, you know, what the natural things have in common.
So just to return to that indefeasible, justified true belief. So like, how would that view, you know, I mean, kind of like touched on this a little bit, but like, how would that avoid, you know, the Gettier case? Well, yeah, like I said, you did kind of already mention this, but just to return for
a second. I mentioned one of the cases. Yeah, actually, I should say undefeated justified true belief, not indefeasible, because it's not that it's impossible to have defeated, it's that they just aren't in the case.
Right. Okay,
anyway, yeah, so, you know, the stopped clock case, just the proposition that the clock is stopped is a defeater. So that explains why you don't know. You know, there were other examples like, okay, so Gettier's original example was something like, you know, this guy, Jones, who has always had a Ford automobile, and like, you've seen the title to the car and it's got his name on it, whatever. So you believe that Jones owns a Ford. Okay. And then, you know, you're sitting there thinking to yourself, gee, what else do I know? Cause I know Jones owns a Ford. Like, I know, like, by, the rules of logic that I learned in my philosophy class, I can infer Jones owns a Ford or Brown is in Barcelona. Right, where Brown is some guy who you have no idea where he is, right? But you just like pick a random city, right? Because, you know, you only need one disjunct to be true. So you're justified in believing Jones owns a Ford or Brown is in Barcelona, inclusive or. Okay. And then, you know, bizarrely, it turns out that Jones doesn't own a Ford. Like, you know, it was totaled just this morning, right? Just before you thought that. So actually, you're wrong. But coincidentally, Brown is in Barcelona. The disjunctive belief is true, right? You are correct that Jones owns a Ford or Brown was in Barcelona. And you had justification for it, right? Because you had good reason to think Jones owned a Ford. So justified true belief, but we want to say you didn't have knowledge. Okay, and then in this case, the defeater is Jones doesn't own a Ford. So if you add that to your belief system, then you're not justified in believing Jones owns a Ford or Brown is in Barcelona. Right, so like the defeasibility theory, it's just super easy to explain all these cases of not having knowledge. It's just very easy to say what the defeater is.
Okay, so like I said, we're jumping around a lot, but I have a lot of questions. So I mentioned kind of the, you know, online like atheist community and how they're, so in my experience, like they're, if you start asking questions about like how they know something or just, you know, start to ask like really foundational questions, there will reach a point where they start like appealing to pragmatic justifications. Like if you say like, you know, we eventually get to this point of like, where, like, why should you be moral, or why should you care about truth, or why should you care about logical consistency? And yeah, it's like kind of this last ditch effort to be like, well, how about you stop caring about those things and see how it works out for you? Like, how about you stop caring about truth and try to navigate the world that way? And it's like, you know, that seems like a plausible enough response in some sense, but I just wanted to hear your thoughts about, you know, that kind of like last ditch pragmatism for foundational stuff.
Totally doesn't answer the question, right? So yeah, why don't you stop caring about truth and see what happens? Well, I'll probably get a bunch of false beliefs.
Yeah.
So what? Because if I don't
care about
truth,
I don't care
about
them.
Like, yeah. Then, okay, what, you know, why don't you stop caring about goodness and value or whatever? Yeah, well, a bunch of bad things will probably happen. Okay. But if I don't care about good and bad, then so what, right? Like, I mean, it sounds like the implied argument is, well, if you didn't care about these things, something bad would happen.
Mm-hmm.
But then, okay, but you have to explain why the thing that we all know is going to happen is bad, right? It just doesn't answer that.
Yeah, it's like, well, if you don't care about truth, then the implication is like, well, you're going to die. Like, you're going to get killed by a tiger or something if you don't care about truth.
Yeah, plausibly right. I mean, if you just totally don't care about any truths across the board, something bad is going to happen. Although a lot of people get by with not caring about certain classes of truths, right?
So how would a phenomenal conservative like handle that question? You get to this like foundational area of like normativity, like why should I care about truth, or why should I care about logical consistency, or like why should I be moral?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, why should I care about truth? So I think there is an answer to that. Or, I mean, maybe this isn't the complete answer, but part of the answer is, well, if you have false beliefs, then most of your goals are going to be pretty hard to satisfy. Like, whatever else it is that you care about, you typically need to have correct beliefs in order to get it. Okay, now, I also think that having correct beliefs has some kind of intrinsic value. You know, why do I think that? Because it's intuitive, I guess. It seems that way to me. It just seems good. Wait, what were the other questions like?
Just like foundational questions about value. Like, why should you value logical consistency?
Oh, yeah. Why do we care about logical consistency? Because if you have inconsistent beliefs, then you're guaranteed to be wrong. So if you believe P and not P, then you know, one of those beliefs is wrong. If you believe the conjunction, then that belief is guaranteed to be wrong. If you want to know why I think it's guaranteed, it's because of the meaning of the word not in English, right? Because like it's basically just by definition, right? Basically, contradictions are by definition false, because to say A contradicts B means they can't both be true at the same time. Okay, and then you're like, okay, and then, you know, why should we be moral? That was another one of the questions. I think that's kind of a nonsense question. Right, because by saying that something is moral, you've already said that it's what you should do. So it's basically saying, why should I do what I should do? Right, or it's asking for a reason for doing the thing that you have most reason to do, where it's stipulated that you have most reason to do it. And now, tell me why I should do it. Like, well, yeah, it's like, you know, it's like those questions like, what color was George Washington's white horse, you know? Like, the answer is already contained in the question.
So you mentioned that, like, you know, truth has intrinsic value. Like, it's just good in and of itself to believe true things. Well, why? Well, it just seems like truth has intrinsic value. So, like, it seems like that option is open to a phenomenal conservative, but not really open to people who want to deny that. Like, how do you determine that truth has intrinsic value other than it just seems like it does?
Yeah, good question, right? I mean, if you're not a foundationalist, then people can just keep asking you, right? Like, there's no stopping point for the reasoning. If you are a foundationalist, then, you know, you might want to say, yeah, the value of truth is foundational. That's a foundational principle. If you're not a phenomenal conservative, then you have to give some other account of what differentiates the foundational propositions from arbitrary and unjustified propositions. So maybe you'd want to say, oh, well, I'm directly acquainted with the value of truth. You know, so that's supposed to be different from just saying that it seems valuable. You know, I could talk about my criticisms of the acquaintance theory. Like, I don't think it ultimately works out. But, you know, in this case, it's not so implausible, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, plausibly there could be some other foundationalist account.
I think one answer I saw recently that kind of even made me think about this whole like kind of last ditch pragmatism I see sometimes was someone was claiming that it's just like a categorical imperative that we should that like truth is valuable or something, or we should like proportion our beliefs to evidence. Does that seem reasonable enough?
I mean, I think that's right. Like, I mean, there are norms of rationality, and they're not dependent upon your desires. Right, like if you're forming beliefs that are totally unconnected to the evidence, then you're being irrational, and you know, epistemically unjustified, whatever, etc. Regardless of what your desires are, so if you want to have false beliefs, that's not going to change the fact that your beliefs are unjustified.
I want to get to a couple fun topics that I was like really wanting to ask you about, specifically with you brought it up earlier, but religious experiences and hallucinogenic experiences, actually, because it seems like I'm hearing some people talk recently about like the epistemic value of some of these like mystical experiences or like ayahuasca trips or something like that. Some people report like, you know, vividly apprehending truths about reality and not just like introspective truths about like their own psychology, which seems like, you know, uncontroversial enough, but like deep metaphysical truths about reality by like, you know, having these hallucinogenic experiences. So are you familiar with any of those developments, and just what do you think about that subject?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard about that, but I haven't gotten a clear understanding of what it is that you see when, you know, like when you take the hallucinogens, and you, people will say something like, well, I came to apprehend that all is one, you know, or whatever. The self is an illusion, and I don't know what they're saying. Okay. So, like when I hear the self is an illusion, I simply don't know what that's supposed to mean. That just sounds incoherent, right? If there's an illusion, who's having the illusion? There has to be someone to experience the illusion, right? So how could the self be an illusion? I just don't even know what that means. Anyway, then everything is one. Like, I'm not sure I understand that either. Like, you mean this finger is identical to this other finger? Because it don't appear to be one. It appears to be two. I don't know. Okay, so, I mean, I think it may be that I just can't understand what they're even saying unless I actually have the experience, right? I suspect that the way that they're describing it in English is misleading, I assume, right? Because otherwise, it's just some obvious falsehoods.
Yeah. No, I was just talking with a friend the other day about how sometimes you'll have these like profound experiences and then you'll try to communicate it and it quickly becomes apparent that it's just kind of ineffable because there's this frustrating tendency for like everything you say when you come back from those experiences to just sound like trivial and like kind of obvious. Like you'll just come back and be like, wow, love is the answer. And it's like, okay. It doesn't seem so profound when you're just saying it, but when you're like experiencing something, you know, and you try to communicate it, and it's just like, hang on, that's not, that doesn't quite communicate what I experienced. Like, yeah, you just kind of have to have the experience yourself.
Yeah. You know, there might be insights that you get, but I mean, it's also possible that these are, you know, false insights, right? Mm-hmm. Because I mean, we are talking about hallucinogens after all, and it's known that they cause you to see things that aren't there.
Well, that's the question though, isn't it? Like, that's what we're trying to figure out, is if those things, like, I remember seeing a clip of Joe Rogan saying that when he's like, you know, for all I know, when I'm taking this, it's like plucking me out of this dimension and putting me into some other like physical dimension. Like, that's sort of what I mean, where some people come back saying like, no, I've ascertained something about physical reality, like through this. And there are some philosophers who are, you know, at least entertaining that, like, maybe we should, you know, analyze why that's wrong. Cause it's not so easy as just saying like, well, those experiences are like chemically mediated. And it's like, well, aren't they all? Like, aren't all of our experiences chemically mediated? That doesn't seem like a defeater at all.
Yes, they are. Yeah. Yeah. But so the thought is, I mean, I think there's particular reason to be suspicious about drug-induced experiences as compared to our normal everyday experiences. And why? Well, so partly because they will cause people to have, I mean, I think the same drugs will sometimes cause people to perceive things with the senses that we know are not there. Right? Like, you know, you hallucinate the pink elephant or whatever, and that nobody is going to say that there really was a pink elephant or whatever. And then, you know, another more general thought is, you know, your brain was designed for, you know, thinking in the ordinary course of events. And if you just like, if you put some chemical that wasn't designed to be in your brain, it's just on the face of it, it's not likely that it's going to improve your cognition. Like it's initially more likely that it's going to interfere with your cognition. If it causes great changes in the way that you perceive things, it's more likely that it's making it worse.
Yeah. And I mean, like, it's always a possibility that we're misinterpreting our experiences. Like, that's always something that's there, but, you know, as you mentioned, like, just that possibility alone isn't a defeater. It's just like, do we have a reason for thinking that, you know, we're mistaken about our interpretation of our experiences? And it's like, in some cases, yes. And in other cases, you know, it's like a lot less clear.
Yeah, no, that's right. So, so notice that my comments about why we shouldn't trust the experience go beyond merely saying, oh, we don't have any proof that it's reliable, right? Like, I'm trying to cite the actual reasons why you would think maybe it isn't. By the way, like, here's an analogy. You know, imagine putting a bunch of some drug in some other part of your body. Is it going to improve the functioning?
Right.
Like, okay, you know, like putting a bunch of drugs in your kidney, there's like some chemical that wasn't designed to be there, just stick it in there. And if your kidney is functioning normally now, that is probably not going to make things better. It's probably going to make things worse.
So I guess that that sounds a little bit like proper functionalism to me, which I brought up earlier, but then I thought we should veer over to the justified true belief stuff.
We got first. Distracted, yeah.
Yeah. So that's another one of those ideas that I find like really interesting. I was reading about it here. I'm just going to, so this is part of Plantinga's theory of warrant. So for people who aren't familiar, I'm just going to read off these like these four aspects of proper functionalism. So one, your cognitive faculties are functioning properly. Two, your cognitive environment is sufficiently similar to the one that your cognitive faculties were designed for. Three, the design plan that governs the production of beliefs is aimed at producing true belief. And four, the design plan is a good one such that there's a high statistical or objective probability that a belief produced under those conditions will be true. So it's just, you have properly functioning cognitive faculties, you're in the right kind of environment that you're, you know, normally in. The design plan that governs your cognitive faculties is actually aimed at producing true belief, because even if it was functioning properly in the right environment, but they weren't designed for like truth tracking, then it wouldn't matter. And also that design plan for truth tracking is actually a good one, and it's actually like, you know, good at achieving that.
Yeah, and I guess we should say for the listeners, like, this is supposed to be the conditions for knowledge.
Right.
You didn't know something. And, you know, my problem with this does not even address the Gettier problem. Like, that doesn't even explain in the Gettier cases why you don't have knowledge, right? So, you know, like the case where the person believes Jones owns a Ford or Brown is in Barcelona. Okay, so how do you arrive at that? Well, he arrived at that by deduction, logical deduction. He did a correct deduction. All right, so he's using the faculty of deductive reasoning, which presumably is truth-directed. It's reliable, you know, it's like a well-designed faculty. And he's in the environment for which it was designed, right? It's not in some bizarre other environment. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it looks like that comes out being knowledge on the proper functionalist account.
Mm. Yeah, that seems to happen a lot, doesn't it? Like, where people add a lot, and then it's just like, oh, this actually doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah, that happens, right?
Yeah, but so is proper functionalism, like, maybe it's not clear what I'm asking here, but my impression when I read your paper was that, so proper functionalism is like an externalist theory, right?
Yeah.
So it seems like phenomenal conservatism, like, it seems like proper functionalism can be made compatible with like phenomenal, like these two ideas can be made compatible. So you can just recognize that phenomenal conservatism is the correct foundational theory. And then you go on to think like, oh, there's definitely something to this proper functionalist theory as well, though. It's just not like the foundational theory, and it's not the right account of knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, what I started to say before was, you know, like, phenomenal conservatism is a view about justification, and proper functionalism is a view about knowledge. So, you know, like, that could be the correct analysis of knowledge. Notice that it doesn't include justification as one of the requirements for knowledge, which I think is weird, but anyway, right. But, you know, it could be that, you know, this is the right account of justification, but justification isn't part of knowledge.
But, you know, I guess I just mean that, like, if those criteria are not satisfied, that would constitute a defeater for a seeming.
Yeah, that seems right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, if your cognitive faculties aren't functioning properly, or if you're in a weird environment or something, then, like, that would be a defeater for an appearance.
Yeah, that's right. By the way, I mean, notice how, you know, I'm promoting the defeasibility theory again, which I learned from my advisor, Peter Klein. So, you know, that I might have been unduly influenced by him, right? But notice how the defeasibility theory just, gets everything, right? So in the case where, your cognitive faculty is not functioning properly, oh, there's a defeater. So the defeasibility theory explains why that's not knowledge. In the case where you have unreliable beliefs, like your belief-forming method is unreliable, that's a defeater also, right? So the defeasibility theory captures the proper function requirements, or captures the reliability requirement. You could take almost any other theory of knowledge and, whatever they say is required for knowledge, you can explain it in terms of defeasibility. So,
mm-hmm. So I'm sorry, you worded this one way. You said it's not indefeasible justified true belief. It's just undefeated justified true belief.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So I started with hallucinogenic experiences, and then I wanted to move to religious experiences. So, as you mentioned, there are like many religious people who are attracted to phenomenal conservatism. I'm inclined to think that like the argument from religious experience, like, is a pretty good argument. Like, it does seem like they're appealing to, okay, so they're talking about these appearances they have, and I can present like reasons for being an atheist or an agnostic or something, but it seems like their actual appearance, like, it's just kind of out of my jurisdiction. It's just like, if they're like feel as if they're directly being appeared to by God, then like I can provide some reasons for thinking that maybe they're misinterpreting that experience. But, I don't really know how I would go about defeating that other than just like, making the entire case for atheism.
Yeah. So, I mentioned before there are two kinds of defeaters, right? They're called rebutting defeaters and undercutting defeaters. The rebutting defeater would be just like trying to give evidence against the existence of God, just independently, right? Independently of your religious experience. The undercutting defeater would be to try to suggest that maybe this type of experience is unreliable. So I think you can make that argument. I think you shouldn't respond to religious experience by just saying, oh, well, you can't prove that it's reliable, right? Because that, again, that applies to everything. But you can say, for example, yeah, but people who are brought up in different religions can have different religious experiences. Like, there are religious experiences had by people with all different religions, and they usually claim that it supports their religion, but they have incompatible religions, right? So this would suggest that maybe it's not reliable, and that the experience is overly influenced by your upbringing and your culture.
Right. So that would constitute a defeater, or like an undercutting defeater?
Alleged undercutting defeater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was accused of being inconsistent recently, and it really bothered me because they were just like, oh, you say that religious experiences probably aren't like a great way for ascertaining the truth about reality, but you're also sympathetic to phenomenal conservatism. So how do you make sense of that? And I was like, well, phenomenal conservatism doesn't mean that you just accept every seeming at face value. Like, you could provide the kind of undercutting defeater that you just offered there, or like many other potential ones.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, so to me, it's plausible that people could have insights, into the nature of life and reality when they have religious experiences. I'm very skeptical that they support a specific religion.
Hmm.
Right. And, partly because of that reason that I said before. But also, like, I'm a little more sympathetic to this, or a little bit more credulous about the religious experience than about the drug-induced experiences, because the religious experiences are not induced by hallucinogenic drugs. Usually, I guess, they could be induced mm-hmm. by drugs, right? But yeah. They could be had when your brain is just, in a seemingly normal condition.
Right. And like I said, I'm inclined to just say that, like, they do have a justification. The people who are having these experiences where, they're just like, look, I'm just seeing God, like, in the same way that I, like, that you see this table in front of you. It's like, well, what else am I supposed to say to that other than, have fun being a theist? Because if you're really having that experience, then, like, like, what can I say to you?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the experience might be sufficiently compelling that you can't, like, even if you give great arguments against the existence of God, they might still think, right, the experience is more compelling. Imagine somebody trying to argue you out of the existence of the table right in front of you, right? It's like, it's going to be really hard. I should say, though, like, I'm very skeptical that these experiences could support very specific claims about God, like that he's all-knowing, all-powerful, and perfectly good or something. Like, I'm very doubtful that you have an experience that shows you all of that to be the case. Or, you know, that you could just tell by the experience that Christianity as a whole is true.
I think even planning to acknowledge it, like, I heard something, it was an interview with him that's, like, somewhat recent, like, maybe a couple years old, and he was, like, pretty squishy on the whole, like, our Judeo-Christian religions all kind of worshiping the same God. And he didn't really want to go all the way and say, like, oh, yeah, they are. But he was, like, surprisingly, because normally when you talk to, like, a Christian, like, they're very quick to shut that down. Like, but he didn't shut it down at all. And he seemed kind of open-minded to the idea that, like, maybe, like, Muslims and Christians and Jews are in fact, worshiping just the same God by a different name. And this was an interview with Justin Brierley on Unbelievable for people who are possibly flipping out right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very plausible. They're kind of in the same tradition. You know, people around here say, oh, the Muslims worship Allah. Well, Allah is just like the Arabic translation of God, right? It just means God. You know, like, why would you say that they're worshiping a different God? Okay, so they have some different beliefs about God. Like, okay, the Muslims accept that Jesus and Moses were prophets of God. And then they just think there was an additional prophet, right, Muhammad, that the Jews and the Christians don't accept, okay? Mm-hmm. And you know, Christianity originated as a Jewish heresy. So, like, it's from the same tradition. So, like, if there is a God and he started off this whole series, it's plausible that all these religions are referring to the same person.
Yeah. I have, like, a thing with Mormonism where I'm just, like, constantly defending it as the most plausible form of Christianity. So I'm tempted just to go off and be like, yeah, and then that happened again. I meant to bring up earlier, intuitions. So just as, like, so there are these intellectual seemings, these intuitions, and they often lead us astray. So some people want to, like, you know, like you mentioned, they're probably not thinking this all the way through, but they want to, like, reject the legitimacy of intuitions altogether, think they just, like, are irrelevant or don't really count very much. So, but our intuitions do often, like, mislead us, like, with probability or physical science. So, you know, science often leads us to these counterintuitive conclusions. So shouldn't that cast doubt on the trustworthiness of our intuitions?
No. Well, yeah, so you can cast doubt on specific intuitions. I don't think you can cast doubt on intuition in general, such that, like, you know, like you would reject any and all intuitions. And I think the people who are saying that are badly confused. They're just, like, you know, pathetically confused, right? So, you know, to try to bring out the confusion, right? Like, oh, okay, so I've heard that people have bad intuitions about probability, so don't listen to your intuitions about probability, right? Okay, and, like, and how do you know that those intuitions are bad? Right, so an example...
Because of the evidence.
Yeah, what is the evidence?
You know, it's just like you can show under experimental conditions that we'll misjudge probability all the time.
And how can we show this? Okay, so let's think about this. So one of the errors that people are supposed to make is the conjunction fallacy. Like they've done these psychology studies where you can get a scenario in which somebody will judge a conjunction to be more probable than the first conjunct, and that is wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay, but wait. How do we know that that's wrong? How do you know that the probability of a conjunction is less than the probability of the first conjunct? Oh, we know that from probability theory. Like, yeah, okay, what about, like, we know that from the Kolmogorov axioms of probability. Like, you can deduce that the probability of a conjunction is less than or equal to, okay? How do we know the Kolmogorov axioms are true? Right? Like, the person who's doing this experiment to say that people are bad at probabilistic reasoning is assuming that he himself can do probabilistic reasoning. How can he do that? So, well, he can do that because he grasps the axioms like the Kolmogorov axioms of probability, which are self-evident. Guess what? That's an intuition.
Yeah.
You're appealing to intuitions.
Yeah, I think some people really don't appreciate how much of our intellectual life is just based on intuition. Like you said, like these kind of, like, you know, mathematical axioms or these like foundational mathematical truths, or like the intuition that, you know, there are no contradictions, or like no proposition that entails a contradiction is true, or something like that. Like, these things do just seem to like bottom out in like brute intuitions when it comes to like math or logic.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what's happening is just that there's a conflict between different appearances. So, you know, like the people in the experiment will make this, you know, stupid judgment about the probability of the conjunction. But, you know, what's happening is that, you know, these are like, they might be undergraduate students who are like getting some course credit for participating in this study or whatever. There's some people who they collected from a newspaper ad, you know, offering to pay them $25 or some trivial thing like that. And so they do not care what the answer to your question is. They don't care. That's why they are not spending time trying to figure it out carefully. And that's part of why they're getting the wrong answer. Okay. But anyway, so this, you know, casual guess that they made is in conflict with the self-evident axioms of probability. All right. So in some sense, the people are having an appearance, but they're having an appearance that's, you know, way less serious than the appearance of the mathematician who's thinking about the correct axioms and deducing the theorems. All right. And so like when you have this conflict of appearances, you go with the one that seems more reliable, and like that's what's happening. It's not that we're showing that appearances can't be trusted. It's that some appearances conflict, and we're deciding these appearances look to us way more reliable than these other ones.
Right. So when it comes to the you know, the misjudgment of probability, like you said, they might not even care because they're just like undergrads who are being paid to participate in this psych study. But like, you know, ultimately this conflict between seemings is between, yeah, something that they're probably not even putting that much thought into, but, you know, even if they were, it's just not as, it's not as solid as this other seeming, which are just like the foundations of probability theory, which are way less controversial and seem way more, you know, trustworthy than, yeah, these other things that are, you know, ultimately going to be based on those. So, I mean, that was my next question, was just, you know, how do you adjudicate these conflicts between appearances? So, you know, like you said, it's just, you just go with the one that seems less controversial, or?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so, in, you know, in practice, it will be complicated series of rules of thumb, right? So, like, if somebody spent more time thinking about something, they're probably more reliable. And, you know, the person who actually cares what the answer is probably more reliable than the person who doesn't care. And just like, you know, there will be sort of, there'll be some consistency conditions, right? Like, so the people who are being unreliable might contradict themselves periodically, right? And, you know, like you can think about whether a person is under the influence of conditions that might bias them. And so, you know, there are some of these psychology studies about ways that people's judgments can be biased. So like you introduce conditions that seem irrelevant, that change the answers that people give to questions. And, you know, what you're doing is just like producing biases. Like you're just like making their cognition less reliable. Like it's not super surprising that it's possible to do that, to trick people or mess them up or whatever. But anyway, so that doesn't mean that you shouldn't trust any judgments. That means that you should trust the judgments where that didn't happen more than the ones where it did. Like we can figure out what some of the biasing conditions are, and then we can try to avoid those conditions.
Right. Okay. So that's how you, you keep anticipating my next question here. So I was going to say like, okay, how do we like handle conflicts between appearances in our own minds? But, you know, also how do we handle conflicts between appearances, like between people who are saying like, it seems to me that X, and then someone else says, it seems to me that Y, and these things are not reconcilable. So how do two phenomenal conservatives handle that situation?
Yeah. You know, so like another thing is, well, sometimes some appearances are stronger than others. So very frequently in philosophy, you find a conflict among, you know, multiple premises that seem plausible, and, you know, jointly they generate a contradiction. So you try to take the one that you think is least plausible and try to figure out how you can give that up. But also sometimes you have like an error theory. You have a theory about why your intuition about something might be mistaken. And so that could be, that could give you reason for giving up that one rather than one of the ones where you don't have an explanation of why it would be mistaken. You know, and you can do this for conflicts between different people as well, though it's more difficult because both parties are inclined to insist that the other one is the one who's biased, right?
I mean, so I have another friend who's like pretty, well, actually it's interesting because most of my like religious friends, you know, who I'll talk to about philosophy on Discord or whatever, like they're pretty open-minded to phenomenal conservatism. And it's more mixed with the non-religious friends, though I do have one atheist friend who said that he read Compassionate Phenomenal Conservatism and then just never read anything else about epistemology because he was like, yep, that about sums it up. Just like never felt the need to read anything else.
So that may be going a little far, but
but you know, it's definitely not like phenomenal conservatism is not like this conversation stopper where it's like, well, it seems to me to be the case. Well, this seems to me to be the case. And then that's just like the end of the conversation. It tends to be like that, like kicks things off. And then you kind of interrogate these appearances and, you know, sort of go through this process that you sketched out.
Yeah. And, you know, I would like to suggest that, well, the way that we should proceed, according to phenomenal conservatism, is the way that we normally do proceed. Like, right. It's not that. You know, I don't recommend that you just go, seems to me that P, okay, let's go home now. And like, well, there are conflicting appearances and then people start talking about them. Like you try to cite other appearances. You look for a case where you agree and see if you can reason from the cases where you agree to the cases where you disagree. But, you know, basically everything that we actually do in philosophy, right, it makes sense on phenomenal conservatism. Everything that we actually do has to do with, you know, relying on the way different things seem to us, right? Different things that seem true to us, and sort of like trying to find the most coherent overall story, that the story that fits best with the overall set of appearances and, you know, gives up the ones that have to be given up, but doesn't give up more than you have to give up.
You know, that was the first thing that jumped out to me when I was reading that paper initially. It was just like, okay, well, regardless of like the normative claims, like this is like accurate. Like it's not, like you said, it's not like you're suggesting that we like all change the way that we're doing things. It's like, no, this is how we do them already. There's just people who don't realize that this is how we do them. So it's like, you know, but yeah, that's because seemings, I think, are just like the kind of the water that we swim in. They're always present and they're always like subtly and sometimes imperceptibly like guiding our philosophical and scientific inquiry. And yeah, I think that you like make a good case that like, and that's okay. That's maybe how it should be.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what is the alternative view, right? Mm-hmm. What's the alternative to relying on the way things seem to us? Like you're going to start from premises that seem false to you or premises that don't strike you as either true or false. You're just going to like randomly pick some things. Yeah. You know, it's like when you think about it, yeah, all of the way that you form beliefs has to do with the way things seem, unless you're doing something blatantly irrational, like maybe forming beliefs based upon what you want to be the case. So that would be an alternative to forming beliefs based on what seems to be the case, but it's obviously irrational. And this leads to, you know, one of my like my favorite argument for phenomenal conservatism. Right? Once you realize that this is how you actually form beliefs, then even the people who are denying phenomenal conservatism are, you know, denying it based upon their appearances, right? Mm-hmm. The way things seem to them. Well, phenomenal conservatism didn't seem true to them, and some other things seem true to them, okay? And so it's going to turn out that, you know, on their view, they shouldn't hold their view.
Right. Yeah, no, I like that argument. It's just the, the argument that all non-PC theories are ultimately self-defeating. Could you sketch out that in a little more detail, just you know, why that is the case?
Yeah, you know, like most philosophers don't like this argument, but I like it. So, so you know, it starts with the premise that the way that people actually form beliefs you know, when they're truth directed, like they're not doing wishful thinking or some obviously irrational thing like that. The way they're forming beliefs is based on how things seem to them. And then there's this other premise that for a belief to be justified, the actual basis of the belief has to be a source of justification. As you have to have believed it for the right reasons, believed it on the basis of something that provides justification for the thing. Otherwise, it's an unjustified belief. Okay, this is known as the basing requirement. And so if you deny phenomenal conservatism, and assuming you're not doing one of these irrational things like wishful thinking or whatever, you're denying phenomenal conservatism based upon the way things seem to you, but your view is that the way things seem to you isn't a source of justification. So that means that your belief in the negation of phenomenal conservatism is an unjustified belief. And that, so that looks like a bad, you know, self-defeating position to be in.
Mm-hmm. In some sense, I'm a bad interviewer here because you just keep, you know, mentioning things like that. And I'm just like, yep,
yeah,
that seems right. you said that philosophers, you know, a lot of them don't really like this argument. What exactly is their problem with it?
I think the dominant response would be to say that, you could say something else about what your belief was based upon. So if you have an alternative theory, like maybe you have the acquaintance theory, you could claim to be acquainted with the facts that make the acquaintance theory true, or something like this, right? Maybe if you have a reliabilist theory, you could avoid self-defeat by saying, well, a reliable belief-forming mechanism led to your belief in reliabilism, right? And so I thought of those things, obviously. And then my response to those things is to try to argue that those are not the actual explanation of your belief, right? So, like, I think that's where the debate goes. So I would say, no, the actual explanation of your belief is not acquaintance, it's appearance. And the reason I say that is if you had the same appearances, but you weren't acquainted with the fact, then you would form the same belief. And if you were acquainted with a fact, but somehow it didn't appear to you to be the case, you wouldn't form that belief. Okay, so the latter might be impossible, right? It might be impossible to have an acquaintance without an appearance, but it is possible to have an appearance without acquaintance. So, like, at least we could use that case. And in such cases, people would have the belief. They do have the belief, right? A good example of this is the comprehension axiom of naive set theory, right? It's something like the axiom that if there is a predicate, then there exists a set of all the things that satisfy that predicate. There's the predicate red, so there's the set of all the red things, right? Which contains all and only the red things. All right, so, and that that seems obviously true to most people who think about it. And that, like, that was accepted as, like, a self-evident axiom of set theory at the beginning. Okay, now, in fact, it's false. We know that it's false because it leads to Russell's paradox. Leads to a contradiction. So that's a case where you have an appearance and you don't have acquaintance. Because, like, among the few things that I know about acquaintance is that you can't be acquainted with a fact that doesn't exist. You can't be acquainted with anything that doesn't exist. So if you have a false cognition, it can't be acquaintance. All right, so people had the intuition in the naive comprehension axiom. So that was an appearance, and it wasn't acquaintance, and people believed it. And what that shows is that people form beliefs based upon the appearances, not based upon acquaintance.
Well, I want to loop back around to something that's like kind of a general thrust of your work, phenomenal conservatism included, which is just that, you know, the value of like common sense and common sense philosophy. You know, people are too quick to dismiss their appearances and their like intuitions as totally irrelevant, or at least they'll profess to believe this. But I think that like preserving the manifest image should be considered like a theoretical virtue. And that's not to say it's the only virtue. It just should, you know, count for something. Like the more counterintuitive your picture of the world is, then the more of a burden you incur. Like it shouldn't just be cost-free to do violence to the way the world appears.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say I appreciate that about your philosophy. I'm kind of coming around to this point of view more and more. The more I've like gotten into philosophy and gotten like frustrated with some things, like starting to appreciate common sense more.
No, that's right. I mean, I think there's a bias towards skepticism among philosophers and among people who think of themselves as having a scientific worldview. And I put it that way because I do not think that the proper scientific approach is to just be like insanely biased towards skepticism of everything, right? Mm-hmm. Proper approach is, okay, let's start from where things appear. You know, let's start by supposing that things are the way they seem to be and see if that works out. And if it, you know, and then if we encounter conflicts so that, you know, it can't be the way that it seems, then, you know, let's try to make the minimum adjustment to our belief system. And that's rationality. That's just rationality, mm-hmm. right? Like jumping to some radically different thing. I think that's caused by passions rather than rationality, mm-hmm. you know, because like people enjoy being skeptical and just have this bias.
Yeah, there does seem to be, like, it's not just that they have that kind of bias in favor of skepticism, but they almost, like, revel in it. Like, they revel in just, like, rejecting common sense and, like, intuitions. And, you know, at the end of it, they're just like, I don't exist, things don't exist, nothing exists. And it's just like, well, that can't be right. Consciousness doesn't exist. It's like, you've gone too far.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun to deny common sense. And then, like, you feel like you kind of feel superior to the ordinary normal people who believe in the real world and whatever. Mm-hmm. We mentioned like the idea that I don't exist. So very few people think that. But like Peter Unger is the one person I know who's argued that he doesn't exist.
But there, you know, with some of those common sense things, I don't know if this is like irrational on my part, but it just seems like I know them. And if there's like some, you know, like I have two hands, 1 + 1 = 2, I'm not dreaming right now. And if there's like some theory of justification or knowledge that means that I don't know those things or I'm not justified in believing those things, then I'm just coming around to thinking that's a reason to just reject that theory. And like, you know, there are things that we just ordinarily think we know and or that we have justification for. And it seems like phenomenal conservatism can like, you know, actually get us there.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think that the problem with skeptics is partly that they're overly credulous and you know, insanely credulous, but only about certain kinds of things, like namely abstract philosophical judgments. They think that you could think about an abstract, you know, philosophical theoretical claim that's highly disputed, and then the thing that vaguely seems to you to be right, you can just like stick to that. Mm-hmm. You know, and just hold to that to the ends of the earth, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, like your theory about what the requirements for knowledge are, right? Because, like, every skeptical argument turns on something like that, like, and knowledge requires this, and then it turns out that this condition is never satisfied or something. Right. And, yeah. So I think, like, if you have a theory about what knowledge requires, and then it turns out that that theory rules out almost everything that you initially thought was a case of knowledge, maybe it's not such a great theory. You should not, like, you know, be absolutely certain that you got the right account there.
No, I think that's a good way of putting that. The skeptics are, like, incredibly credulous, but only about certain things. Because, like, that's an accurate description of what I was like, you know, a few years ago. I guess maybe more than a few years ago, but back when skepticism, like, you know, bothered me, like, on an emotional level. You know, like thinking about the world being created 5 minutes ago, or, you know, that I'm in the Matrix or something like that. Like, yeah, I mean, when you think about it, like, those things definitely are, you know, like, there's really no reason to think that that's the case, that I was created 5 minutes ago with all my memories. And it's like, yeah, to really be bothered by that is like a form of credulity, but like, you know, just in a very specific way, only in these like abstract philosophical scenarios.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so, you know, there are different kinds of special pleading that philosophers get into, right? So, you know, skeptics are people who apparently, like, trust their a priori intuitions about philosophy more than their sensory perception. And empiricists are people with the opposite problem, right? Like they trust sensory perception, but they don't trust their a priori judgments.
Actually, that was one of the issues that I wanted to talk to you about. I just wasn't sure if we were going to have time for it. But so there's this dispute between, you know, rationalists and empiricists. And so, I mean, where do you fall in those two categories?
You know, so I believe in a priori knowledge, including, I guess, synthetic a priori knowledge. I say, I guess, because like I'm not super clear about the distinction between synthetic and synthetic and analytic, right? But you know, the empiricists are definitely wrong. You know, I have some papers about this. I think that the traditional rationalists had some kind of mistakes, and so I think they had a, you know, like Descartes and Spinoza and whatever, they had the mistake of thinking that most knowledge is top down. That you start from some like universal sweeping generalization and then deduce stuff from it. And that's how the way you should go about knowing stuff about the world. That is a mistake. But then the empiricists have the kind of more blatant mistake of just not thinking there's any a priori knowledge, right? Or not thinking there's any substantive a priori knowledge of reality. Hmm. You know, like it's all just like about the meanings of words or something.
I don't want to like switch metaphors here, but you mentioned like that the rationalists made this mistake of thinking that knowledge was like top down. Isn't that just a description of foundationalism though? That like you start with these like, you know, things that are sort of infallible, and then you like try to work your way from there inferentially.
I mean, that's a form of foundationalism, right? But so, you know, on my version of foundationalism, the foundations are not infallible, or, you know, not even really close. Most of them are not close to infallible. Yeah, what's the difference between my version and like Descartes? I have a lot more foundational propositions, I think, right? Which is to say, everything that initially seems to you to be the case has some foundational justification, but at the same time, it's revisable because it could conflict with something else that seems to you to be the case. And so then you have to revise one of these foundations.
So it's like the category of appearance. It's not like the actual like individual appearances. Like those are revisable, but the category of appearance isn't revisable.
That statement sounds like a category error. That is, a category can't be revised. Like only a belief could be revised.
Well, you know, like the foundation is like appearance on your view, but like the specific appearances can be like, the contents can be revised.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I don't like, could there be something that could make you give up on using appearances in general? I don't see how, right? Because like, what is it going to be? It's going to have to be some appearance. Like, maybe you would get some appearance that tells you that all of your appearances are unreliable. Like, is that possible? Mm-hmm. I guess that maybe that's possible.
Well, I don't want to, because I know this is maybe not how the terms are traditionally like used in this discussion of like, you know, classical foundationalism, but. Isn't that in a way proposing an infallible foundation? If it can't be, like, if any denial of it is self-defeating and like it can't really be gotten away from?
Well, let's see. I mean, is phenomenal, so this is, you know, one thought, is phenomenal conservatism itself, that epistemological theory, is that indefeasible? I don't think so. And I don't think that it implies that it's indefeasible, because like, no, it could be evidence against it. You know, it could turn out that it conflicts with the appearances, I guess. Right? But I don't think that it does. But, you know, like, if there were a bunch of stuff that seemed to us to be justified, but didn't seem true, then that would conflict with phenomenal conservatism. Okay, but, you know, you might think maybe it didn't mean like the belief in PC itself, but sort of like there's a foundational method. I don't know. Like there are methods of forming beliefs, and like there are methods of forming beliefs that you will be using no matter what, you know, as long as you're alive, as long as you're forming beliefs, right? And if you give a sufficiently abstract general characterization of what the methods are, then they can't be changed. But, you know, if you give more specific descriptions of your methods, then you could have reason to revise them, but you would have to revise them using some other, like, more basic or more general method or something.
I wanted to ask, though, about, you know, we've touched on this, like, in a few different ways, but it seems like one of the main problems people have with phenomenal conservatism is just that there are all these, you know, appearances that don't seem like they should be trusted. And, like, there are these, you know, like, in the case of, like, schizophrenics or something like that, or in the case of, you know, people who are misinterpreting their experiences, which, you know, we know has to happen, like, all the time. So, like I said, I know we've kind of been, we've kind of, like, touched on this already, but, you know, how do you handle that sort of objection that, like, well, how can phenomenal conservatism be true since we know that so many of our appearances are, like, crazy or shouldn't be trusted?
Yeah. And, you know, and how do we know that? And, you know, when you think about it, it's going to be that you know it based upon some appearances. Okay. But, you know, note that people can have justified beliefs that are not true. And this is not like a problem for a theory of justification. Like if what you're looking for is, tell me the belief forming method that's infallible. Like, right, tell me how people could form beliefs so that they're none of them are ever mistaken. Well, there is no such method. Like, the only thing that you could have is not form any beliefs at all, then you won't have any mistakes. That's the only thing that we know of, right? But anyway, so yeah, so there could be somebody who has misleading appearances. You know, you mentioned schizophrenics who they're having hallucinations. Okay, but, you know, think, and so they're wrong. So they have some false beliefs, and so that's a problem. Okay, but think, like, what really is your judgment about justification? Like, what does it make sense for them to believe? Not from your point of view, right? But from their point of view, like, they're hearing voices. So let's say that you're hearing these voices which sound to you just like the voices of normal people. And so you think that those are real voices. Okay, and then unbeknownst to you, you're hallucinating. Okay, so yeah, you're mistaken, so you don't have knowledge, whatever. Mm-hmm. But what did it make sense for you to think at the time? Like, well, it made sense for you to think that those were actual sounds. I mean, like, that's why people think that when they have a hallucination. Right. Like, okay, now I should say, I think that's not all that's going on. Okay, so, like, in addition to having distorted sensory perception, they might have distorted reasoning processes. So they may, in fact, not be reasoning correctly. You know, there might be signs that you should detect that, you know, that indicate the unreliability of your hallucinations. You know this story about John Nash, the famous game theorist? Like, mm-hmm. Okay, you know, so very brilliant, brilliant game theorist, and he was also schizophrenic. And the story is that he eventually figured out that some of the people he was hallucinating were not real because they never aged. So he'd been hallucinating the same person for years and they never aged. And so then he realized that he had some cognitive disorder.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I just think that there's this, like, persistent misconception that it's just like, you know, like, things appear to you a certain way and, like, you know, they forget that part about, you know, in the absence of defeaters. And it's like, you know, phenomenal conservatism is not the view that you're, like, forbidden to come to any position that's at odds with your immediate appearance or intuition. It's like, because, you know, John Nash, like, found that particular defeater and, you know, correctly reasoned his way away from this initial appearance.
Yeah. So that's right. So that's, like, you know, that's one of the things that illustrates. I think that there are, you know, other people who have hallucinations who don't reason their way out of it. And I think that's partly because their reasoning has been distorted, right? And so, you know, like, in addition to the perceptual distortion, right? And so in that case, I guess I would say they don't have justified beliefs, right? Because they do have defeaters and they're just not applying them.
You know, and there was an example you gave in the encyclopedia entry on this about someone who, like, so this isn't the case of, like, a schizophrenic, but someone who, like, looks at a tree and just says, like, that tree was planted on, you know, April 3rd, 1914 or something. And like, they don't know where that came from. Like, they're not disposed to saying things like that or whatever. And it's like, you know, so like, would a phenomenal conservative be committed to being like, well, you know, you're justified in thinking that, you know, that the tree was planted on April 3rd, 1914.
Yeah. You would have some justification in the absence of defeaters, right? But then, like, this is such a bizarre example. Like, I don't even know what it would be like to have such an appearance. Is it even possible to have an appearance that a tree was planted on a specific date? And if that thought occurred to me, I would assume that either I learned that at a previous time that I've forgotten, or what? Or, you know, there was something wrong with my brain, right? Because that's not the way things normally go. You don't have thoughts like that appear. So I would think, you know, maybe I do have a defeater, or, you know, maybe I would assume that I learned it in some other way previously, and this is like a memory that I'm not recognizing as such. And then I would think I am to some degree justified in believing that. But note that you know, like the way that I formulate phenomenal conservatism more recently is that you have some justification. So it doesn't say that you have a really high degree of justification, right? And, you know, in this particular case, if it doesn't cohere with any of the rest of your belief system, it would be a low degree of justification.
Right. And you know, when it comes to weird things like that, I mean, I think it just comes down to, you know, where are you on the like X-Files spectrum of like Mulder to Scully? Like if someone just says like this tree was planted on this date, you know, Mulder might like hear you out and, you know, Scully would say something like you just said. But it's like, I don't know. I feel like it's maybe good to have some humility in areas. Yeah, I don't think that we're anywhere close to knowing everything. And even though it's like, yeah, it's true, it's not how things normally go. It's like, I don't think you know, we should just rule out a priori, like, weird stuff, unexplained things that, you know, skeptics and materialists are, like, less disposed to accept and tend to just, like, rule out without thinking about it.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I prefer realistic examples. You know, so, like, one of the things I don't like about that example is that I have no idea what it would be like to have that appearance, so it's hard for me to have intuitions about it. But I think there are cases where people have other appearances that are sort of disputed. Like they feel like they're having precognition. They have a premonition about something. Okay. And in that case, I think, well, yeah, yes, you do have some justification, right? You have a premonition, like you're about to get on an airplane. You have this premonition that maybe the airplane is going to crash or whatever. And, you know, do you have some justification for thinking that the airplane may crash or some justification for expecting it to crash? I guess I think, yes, you do, right? And, you know, other things being equal, yeah, maybe don't get on the plane. You know, like, of course, you know, other things are not usually equal. So, you know, but like if you didn't really have any reason for getting on that plane to begin with, and then you have a premonition that you're going to die if you get on the plane, don't get on the plane.
Right. Or if you have like an anxiety disorder, like you probably, you know, you probably shouldn't listen to that because you know that you tend to like have these anxious like episodes, like when stressful things are about to happen or something along those lines. But that would be a case of it not being equal. Oh yeah. I had one other example of like a weird thing where like people have, you know, cause we mentioned like how phenomenal conservatism can like get you to have a justified belief in like memory, you know, not just like intuition and sense perception and beliefs about other minds and stuff like that, but also memory. And some people claim to have memories of like past lives and stuff like that. There's not really any known mechanism. Well, I guess there are some, you know, like reincarnation is like a pretty old belief and that sort of thing. But so, I mean, you would agree that there are like, there's at least some degree of justification when someone who, you know, all things being equal claims to have a memory, but it's of a previous life.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, by the way, like some degree of justification is a pretty weak claim.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, I think, you know, you're going to have to agree that there is some degree of justification, right? So like, yeah, you know, if there are a bunch of people who are saying that they remember past lives, then maybe they do. You know, can't rule that out. And like my credence that people had past lives, given that a bunch of people seemingly remember past lives, is higher than my credence that people lived in the past if nobody had any such memories, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that means there's some degree of justification, right?
Right.
I mean, like, yeah, if nobody ever thought that they remembered a past life, then, you know, your credence would be low.
Right. Right.
It would be much lower that that was the case. Right. And now, you know, I mean, in fact, I think that those past memories are false.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's the most likely thing. But, you know, so, like, it would be worth investigating, right? When I say, like, your credence is somewhat higher, like, it's, yeah, it would be worth, like, spending some time seeing if there is, like, when the people claim to remember past things, if they can draw out memory, they can draw out information about the past that they wouldn't have other ways of accessing, mm-hmm. and it turns out to be accurate, like, that would be a thing to look into.
Right. I was just going to say, that's what I was getting at earlier when I was saying, maybe we should be, like, more humble about things that we, you know, because it seems like a lot of skeptics, it's like, that's just in the wrong category of things, you know, like, it doesn't matter, like, what the evidence is or anything. It's just like, that is just the wrong kind of thing that could be true. So it's like, it's no, that's just ruled out a priori. And I'm just kind of inveighing against that, where it's like, if they make any argument at all, they'll just appeal to some case where it was like an obvious fraud, or they'll, and then say that, you know, or they'll make a sort of lazy argument from like the core theory or something, where it's like, well, what we know about physical science is in conflict with this, because we do experiments in a particle accelerator, so that means that we don't have a soul or something, which is a pretty bad argument. But
yeah, no, you know, like the world is complicated and often mysterious, and so I don't know how the memories could be transmitted. I don't know how that information could be recorded and transmitted. But I'm not certain that it couldn't be. Like, I'm not saying that it can be. I'm just saying I'm not sure that it can't. So it would be worth looking into, right? Like, I don't know. Just have an open mind about the world. The world is going to surprise you. You know, it surprised us a lot of times in the past. It will continue in the future.
Yeah. So just one more question I wanted to ask you, which is about just counterintuitive conclusions, things that if you just proposed, they would seem false, like they seem at odds with common sense. And, but it's like all the steps along the way, like all the steps in the argument are intuitive. So like that's happened to me a few times where there will be like, okay, well, you've got these like three or four premises. They all seem way more plausible than not. But when you take them together, there seems to be this implication of something that's like, you know, pretty counterintuitive. So do you think, like, you know, would it have to just be a case by case basis thing, or do you have some general rule about like what's more important, like the conclusion or the steps that got you to the conclusion?
Yeah, no, that happens a lot in philosophy, right? Mm-hmm. And that happens with paradoxes. Like, you know, I have a book about paradoxes, which is you know, which will be fun to read. But yeah, okay, so, you know, what do we think about the weighing the premises versus a conclusion? Well, in fact, like what counts as the conclusion is dependent upon, you know, like an arbitrary choice at the beginning, right? Because you could have taken the negation of the conclusion as a premise instead and deduced the negation of one of the premises and called that your conclusion. So what actually happens is, you know, you have a collection of propositions which are jointly inconsistent. All right. So, you know, see if I can give a reasonably short example, like, you know, Zeno's paradox. Okay, so, like, here's an argument that motion is impossible, right? In order to move from point A to point B, an object has to complete an infinite series. Namely, it has to go to the halfway point, and then the three-quarter mark, and then the seven-eighth mark, etc. Okay, and second premise, it's impossible to complete an infinite series. Conclusion, no object can move. All right, so that, well, I guess that follows from the first two premises. Okay, and then now, but here's another argument. In order to go from point A to point B, you have to complete an infinite series, blah, blah, blah. Second premise, objects move sometimes from one point to another. Conclusion, you can complete an infinite series. And so, okay, so like what counts as the premise and what counts as the conclusion is just dependent upon which one of these we thought of first, but that's epistemically irrelevant, right? So what's actually happening is, well, there's just like three propositions that are inconsistent, right? that moving from one point to another requires completing an infinite series, that you can't complete an infinite series, and that things move. Those are jointly inconsistent. And now we just have to say which one of those things is the least obvious. And it's can't, it's not that things move. That's not the least obvious premise. That's the most obvious premise. So that's not the one you should reject. Reject one of the other two. Okay, now that doesn't totally that doesn't totally solve everything. It's like, okay, by the way, some people would say, oh, I'm going to reject the other one. I'm going to say you don't have to complete an infinite series, right? And then you have to say space is discrete or something like that, okay? But this doesn't solve everything. That tells you shouldn't believe that nothing moves, but doesn't really explain the problem, right? It doesn't explain away the paradox, because it doesn't explain, well, why does it falsely seem like you can't complete an infinite series? Like, you have to explain, like, well, why? How can you complete an infinite series, right? Or why did I think that you can't complete an infinite series? You know, like, what went wrong in my thinking there? Okay, there's no algorithm for answering that. Like, we got to think more about the nature of the infinite in this case, but it's going to be, that's not going to help you solve any other case, right? Okay, but this does tell you, you should not do what the philosophical skeptics do and what a whole bunch of philosophers do, which is embrace the least plausible.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so is there anything else that you wanted to touch on before we head out?
No, I don't know. I didn't have anything particular.
I mean, I guess I'll just end by saying that, phenomenal conservatism can account for the justification of many different kinds of belief, like our own minds and other minds and moral truths and mathematical truths and beliefs about sense experience and intuition and memory. And this really simple idea, can justify belief and all that. So if nothing else, we should at least want it to be true.
Sounds good, yeah.
All right. Hey, thanks again for taking the time. I really do appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me.